Well, they say that context is everything when it comes to understanding what is being said. There's a story that I've heard variously, but I'll tell you the story in the form of a bishop who found his way, who found out to his cost the danger of losing context. He is said to have arrived in New York on an official visit, and a journalist shouted out as he was walking through the airport, Mr. Bishop, or Your Reverend, or whatever the appropriate address was, will you be visiting any nightclubs while you are in New York? And the bishop replied, are there any nightclubs in New York? Well, he could have been speaking in complete innocence, but as likely as not, he was speaking in ironic, mock innocence. At any rate, he would not have been expecting the headline in one of the newspapers the next morning. Bishop lands at JFK and asks, are there any nightclubs in New York? Strictly speaking, that's what he had asked. But the context told us that that wasn't what he meant. Some of you may find those words coming to mind when you read the verse on the program. Context is everything, and these words that I've written out just under sermon are pretty hard to understand without any context. For just as through the disobedience of the one man, the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of the one man, the many will be made righteous. And that may leave us with a whole series of questions. Who is the one man that's referred to twice? Is that the same person each time, or a different one man each time? Who are the many? Again, they're mentioned twice. Is it the same people, the same many each time, in each half of the verse? And what are the disobedience and the obedience which are referred to? And even if I gave you the key that the man in the first line is Adam and the man in the second line is Jesus, you'd probably not be much the wiser. It's somewhat veiled and mysterious with that verse on its own. So let me try to explain what Paul is saying here and what I think it has to do with Christmas. I've found it helpful to think in terms of a concept that Paul would have known nothing about, but one I think he might have used in this context, in this situation, if the science had got that far by then. And it's the concept of DNA and how that gets passed on down the generations. One of my pleasures just after Christmas, in fact, hopefully flying on Christmas Day, will be to pop over to England to see family. My brother and sisters have now produced 12 nephews and nieces for me, so it's not that easy to keep up with all of them, but I do my best. And one of the things I enjoy doing is observing which quirks they have inherited from their parents, which Eigenheiten they have inherited and geerbt. For example, both my brother and my one sister have a quirk of screwing up their face in a very distinctive way when they're concentrating very hard. Different sort of grin in each case, but still very intense. I remember my father always trying to cure them of it, saying, stop grinning, and it had no effect whatsoever. It was deeply ingrained in the genes. Well, sure enough, one child of each of those brothers and sisters does exactly the same. It's quite uncanny. I look at them and I think, I'm 30 years ago and see my brother or my sister. Well, is it imitation or is it inbred? Seems to me it's the latter. It's a case of dodgy DNA, defective DNA being handed on. Even more disconcerting, beunruhigend, is when they also display certain quirks, usually sort of behavioral quirks, which are said by others to be reminiscent of their uncle. Now that's harsh. Here's me doing my best to prevent any dodgy DNA being handed down the generations. I'm still single. But all the dodgy stuff that I inherited is being passed on a sort of bypass system. I won't go into details of the particular habits, the particular tendencies which are reputed to be visible in my nephews and nieces. Suffice it to say, there must have been some quite eccentric ancestors whose dodgy genes are pretty much indestructible. But in a way, I'm actually quite proud of my nephews and nieces for these quirks that I do occasionally see in them. But it is rather disconcerting to see the power of DNA. I'm not one of these people who thinks that DNA dictates our behaviour. We're free human beings. But it does clearly influence the way we are, the way we live. It gives us tendencies, Neigungen. It predisposes us. It makes us anfällig to behave in certain ways. Now, if you transfer that idea from the behavioural to the spiritual sphere, I think you may get a rough idea of what this verse is trying to tell us. Think in terms of two kinds of spiritual DNA, which come from two distinct sources. There's the DNA that we inherit through, as it's put here, the disobedience of the one man, that's Adam. And then there's DNA that we are able to inherit through the obedience of the one man, the second of the one man, and that is Jesus. I should add that in both cases the German would have Mensch there rather than Mann, because the Greek is that word. The significance is being humans rather than being males in that verse. But poor old Adam, not so much famous for 15 minutes, but famous because of 15 minutes or so. And the story has become part of our culture. We've all heard the expression, for example, the forbidden fruit. And I imagine most of us have heard the story, even if we haven't read it for ourselves. God had given Adam and his wife a wonderful place to live in. He'd given them instructions to enjoy it to the full, make the most of it. But there was just the one condition, not to eat fruit from just one of the many trees in the garden. So although it sounds a pretty insignificant action when they reached out their hands and picked that one piece of fruit, in the context, it meant a whole lot more. It was a deliberate act of disobedience. It was a kind of declaration of independence. It was a decision about who would be making the rules from now on. And so Adam became famous as the man who did things his own way, not God's way. The man who chose to walk his own path rather than to walk with God. And that attitude didn't die with Adam. That attitude became part of the spiritual DNA of each and every human being. It's been handed on down the generations since then through the disobedience of the one man, the many, all of us actually, were made sinners. It's left us with this inbuilt tendency, Neigung, to do our own thing, to be anfällig, susceptible for disobedience, not obedience. In a way, that's our default option. That's the option we keep reverting back to. However much we try and put on some different settings, we always revert back to that tendency. A tendency which shows itself in our behaviour towards one another. None of us finds "you first" comes as easily to us as "me first." And it's a tendency which shows itself in our behaviour towards God. That's where the word sin comes in. Doing things our way, not God's way. And that's all the situation, I think, summed up by the first half of that verse. Just as through the disobedience of the one man, the many were made sinners. But according to the second half of the verse, that's not the last word on the human race. So also, through the obedience of the one man, the many will be made righteous. There was one man in human history who didn't inherit this dodgy DNA from the first Adam. One man who always resisted the temptation to make up his own rules. Not my will, but your will be done. Who always walked with God and not apart. So he was very different from Adam in all sorts of ways. He was almost the polar opposite of Adam. Yet Jesus is sometimes referred to as the second Adam. And that's because there's one key point at which he is like Adam. What he did had consequences for all of humanity. His work of obedience made many righteous. And so just as the consequence of Adam's disobedience was that we all now inherit his DNA, so it's now possible through Christ's obedience for anyone who wants to be on the receiving end of the Jesus DNA. Now, quite how that comes to be possible would take us on a journey for which we don't have time, a journey from Jesus' birth all the way to Jesus' death, from Christmas to Easter. But we will hear a little about it in the next few readings and carols, in the next song, which will be sung as a solo for us to reflect on some of these things and think about them further. In that next song, we hear of one of the ways in which Jesus cleared the way for us to inherit his DNA. And the idea there is that in Adam, as descendants of Adam, we're more than anfällig to sin, more than susceptible. We're actually held captive by sin. We're not free to give ourselves another setting. We're not free to live as God intended. If you like, the devil has locked us up as his prisoners, all because that first Adam failed. But not so the second Adam, if you look at that, at the first of the stanzas there. O loving wisdom of our God, when all was sin and shame because of the consequences of the first Adam, a second Adam to the fight and to the rescue came. And the next verse tells us that he was successful in that fight. He prevailed, that means he won. O wisest love, that flesh and blood, which did in Adam fail, should strive afresh against the foe, should strive and should prevail. What actually made me think of this song in my preparation was that a few weeks or a month or two ago, in a magazine that I get, there was some correspondence in the letters column about the third of the verses you find here. And one of the correspondents described it like this. This verse is an example of hymnal poetry in which the grammar and diction are so convoluted and compressed that the sense remains impenetrable, which is probably true of that sentence as well. But I think you may see what I mean if I read it to you. O generous love, that he who smote in man for man the foe, the double agony in man for man should undergo. It has to be said, the meaning of that verse doesn't exactly leap out of the page and hit you in the face. It is actually expressing a profound truth. You have to remember that the first man in each of those doublets is Christ, and the second is all humanity. But I'll leave you to reflect on that while it's being sung. You'll be pleased to hear that the following readings and the carols and the songs we'll be singing are less dense and compact than that particular verse. If you look at the second verse of the next song, through one man, that is Adam, there came darkness and strife. Through one man there came sin's dreadful stain. And then you notice the capital letter. Through one man, Jesus, there came hope of new life. Through one man we shall live again. And before we move on to listening to those to one song being sung and sing the other song and listen to the readings, I want to leave you with one last picture regarding the old DNA which we have in Adam and the new DNA which is available in Christ. There was a prophet called Ezekiel who lived many hundreds of years before Christ, and here's what he talked about what would happen when the second Adam came. God speaking. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I'll put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws." I suggest that's a wonderful description of the new DNA which is available in Christ. He's not saying that those who follow Christ will become perfect overnight. But he is saying there will be change, profound change from the inside out. God's Spirit will work in us to bring about transformation, to clean out the old, the heart of stone, to bring in the new, the heart of flesh, the heart that desires to go God's way. And in essence, a Christian is someone with new desires and new longings and new loves which God has given them. It's not someone who's sitting in a corner and looking at themselves and thinking, "What a good boy am I?" It's not someone hoping that others will be looking at them and thinking, "What a good boy is he?" A Christian is simply a person who is in the process of being transformed, someone who has received a new heart, someone in whom God's Spirit has begun to dwell and be at work, someone whose Adam DNA is being replaced by the Jesus DNA. So as we listen to the next song and hear the last readings and sing the remaining carols, you might want to be asking yourselves, which DNA is active in me? That of the first Adam or that of the second Adam? Which way does my heart lean? Towards walking my own way or towards walking God's way? Towards being in tune with God or towards being in tune just with myself? And which is the way I actually want to be and want to live? You see, the offer is on the table and it's available to all. Just as through the disobedience of the one, the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. At Christmas, we remember why Jesus came into the world, God in human flesh. But we remember too the opportunity that he has opened up for us. All we have to do is reach out and receive it. "I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws."